Welcome back to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. NASA has big plans for space exploration, sending astronauts into deep space and eventually Mars. To do that, they're going to need a rocket that's bigger than anything ever seen before and a spacecraft capable of protecting astronauts for the long journey. Meanwhile, private space companies are working to make space travel cheaper with rockets that can be landed and reused. And in the furthest reaches of the solar system, unmanned space probes are making new discoveries about the planets, and you can help. We're here to talk more about the latest developments. 90.7 space reporter Brendan Byrne and Emily Speck, who writes for the Orlando Sentinel's Go for Launch blog. Well, let's start with Orion. It's bound for Mars ultimately, but it's heading to the moon first. Now, Brendan, you went out last week to take a look at Orion. What can you tell me about it?
Well, it's this really giant shell, basically. So it's sitting in the middle of the operations and checkout facility, which was retrofitted from the Apollo program. This is where they put the Apollo capsules together, and then for a brief moment it was used for shuttle astronaut housing. But now it's going to be assembling this Orion capsule, and they're calling it the pressure vessel. It was put together in Michoud out in New Orleans. So basically it's like a chassis of a car. It's just right. The bare bones of it.
How big is it?
It's pretty big. It's originally supposed to hold about 6 people. It's going to hold now 4, but I mean, it's bigger than I thought it was going to be, actually. If you can think of those Apollo capsules, it's a tad bigger than that. So what they're going to do is just they're going to add all of the stuff to it at the Kennedy Space Center in the operations and checkout facility.
How did they get this giant pressure vessel to Kennedy?
It's in the Super Guppy. It's just like a wide-bodied plane, and it looks like a guppy fish or a little minnow fish, but at this massive scale, and it actually unhinges from right around the front of it, so they actually unhinge it and put the capsule in that way.
Okay, so the Orion is going to the moon before it goes to Mars. Mm-hmm. What can you tell me about that mission? When does it launch?
Well, they're slating that mission for 2018. What this is going to do, it's going to test out quite a few different things. So they've got the Orion capsule, they've got the SLS rocket that's going to get it into space, and then the ground system, so the launch pad. So all of these things are being developed separately, and they all have to come together for this 2018 mission. So they're going to launch it to the moon. It's going to orbit the moon a little bit. They're going to learn about how it works in deep space. It's the first time they're going to send a human-rated capsule that far since the Apollo program. And they're really looking just to see how it fares, how the systems work, and how it manages out in deep space.
Right. And this isn't the first time they've fired an Orion capsule up into space.
No, they had the EFT-1, they call it. That was in 2014. That went up into a high orbit, and they were really testing the structure of the Orion. So to see if the actual walls and welds held up, and also the heat shield, which is really important. They say sent it really, really high trajectory, and it came down really, really fast. That generates a lot of heat, so they were testing all those systems out to make sure that the capsule would be able to house humans safely.
What have they done to it between the first test flight and what they're planning for it next?
Well, they pulled a lot of weight out of it, and they're also streamlining manufacturing as well. I'm going to let Mark Geyer of NASA explain.
You want to fly these a lot, so you got to get the manufacturing costs down. And one of the things that drives cost is time. So you cut down the number of welds at Michoud, and then you don't have to spend so much time doing that. You bring it in, you get them done, you send it here, and you start throwing stuff in it.
So what stuff are they throwing in it?
So they're going to be putting avionics in there, which is all of the flight systems. They've got flight computers in there, and they're going to be putting on a new heat shield. They're also going to be taking some CubeSats with them, which is really interesting because CubeSats are those little tiny satellites, usually secondary payloads. So if there's a mission going up, they kind of shove them somewhere and find a place for them. But those have been limited to low Earth orbit so far. Now, with this Orion capsule heading to the moon, some of these CubeSats, they might be deployed in deep space, which is really cool.
Emily Speck, you've got your sights set a little bit further out on Jupiter. What's happening there? What's the name of the spacecraft?
Yeah, NASA has the Juno spacecraft. So it's set to arrive at Jupiter on July 4th.
When did they launch it?
They launched it in 2011. It had a planned course correction a couple days ago, and that went well. So it's going to orbit the sun and then continue on towards Jupiter.
What are they hoping to find out about Jupiter?
Jupiter is a giant gas planet. So there's a lot of the atmosphere is very thick, covered in clouds. You can't see through that. They don't know exactly what's inside the center of the planet. So they're going to use Juno to monitor the weather and Jupiter's atmosphere. And they're also going to have something on the spacecraft called the JunoCam, taking photos of the planet, and people will be able to select different areas of Jupiter that they think NASA should look into. Mm-hmm. So it's really going to be the spacecraft of the people.
They're kind of crowdsourcing some of the research.
Yes, yes.
Is this the first time NASA's done something like that?
They did test the Juno cam earlier with some Earth images, but that I know of, it's the first time that they're really going to be using people here on Earth that don't work at NASA as the visual imaging team.
Why are they doing this? Is it to save money or is it just to get more people interested in space exploration?
Jupiter is huge, so you can't ever look at the whole thing at one time. And so they're hoping that when Juno moves further away from the planet, that they'll be able to crowdsource the images and so people can spot things. They'll be using more people to see the planet because it's like 1,000 Earths. It's insane. It's huge. So they're hoping that people will be able to spot things that a smaller team of scientists would have missed.
Emily Speck, New Horizon was a pretty popular mission, a lot of interest in that, and the data keeps kind of spilling in after its flyby Pluto last year. What are some of the things that investigators are looking at from that flyby?
Most recently, they came back with a couple new scans that showed there is more water ice on Pluto than previously thought. There were two scans. They used different methods. The second scan looked for pretty much anything that would flag water ice, and it came back with a lot. That was kind of surprising, and they actually think that there's even more than that, but that it is covered with methane or other elements. So they think that there could be more water ice on Pluto, which is pretty interesting.
What's next for New Horizon then?
Well, New Horizon, it has its sights set on another object in the Kuiper Belt. NASA still has to approve the mission, but it's still headed there for now, and it's still healthy.
There's one more deep space probe that you've been following as well, Cassini.
Yeah, so NASA's Cassini spacecraft is studying Saturn, and in 2017, Cassini will actually be flying through the rings of Saturn. So that's going to be really interesting and very dangerous. All that debris, particles, it's mostly water ice in Saturn's rings. So it's going to be interesting what it finds. But most recently, there was a study that found that the B ring does not have as much stuff in it as previously thought. It's this ring you can't really see through, so you would think that it's, you know, full of stuff, but they measured the density of it, and it doesn't really seem like it has as much stuff in it.
So they look pretty from a distance, but they're pretty dangerous up close.
Yes, if you're a spacecraft and you're flying very fast, hitting a big chunk of water ice or debris from another planet, it could be fatal for you.
How do they steer that thing through the debris field then?
With nerves of steel. No, they have teams of people that make course corrections, and it's a solar-powered spacecraft, so that's also very important. But no, there are teams of people devoted to making sure that Cassini survives.
And it's really far away, too, so when you try to control it, there's a bit of
a
lag, right? So it's going to be really stressful trying to fly that thing.
Now, that's one of the problems that NASA missions to Mars are going to find, too, right? Like communicating from the spacecraft back to Earth once they actually send humans out that far.
Right, and that's something that they're looking into. Going back to the Orion spacecraft, they're building in a lot of autonomy on that. So not only will that spacecraft be able to control itself, think back to the Apollo missions, there had to be one person that stayed in that command module while it was orbiting the moon and they were down there just to control it. With Orion, they won't have to do that. That thing can completely run itself. And also the astronauts have a lot more control over the systems in the other case where they need to fly it themselves. They're definitely taking that into account because you're right, Mars is far away.
So Orion's kind of like the self-driving car of the spacecraft.
A very expensive self-driving car, yes.
Emily, let me just ask you this. I mean, we saw plenty of public excitement about the Mars rover landing way back in 2012. How much interest do you see, public interest in these unmanned scientific missions compared to human spaceflight? And just how important is that for NASA?
Well, NASA has a great social media presence, as pretty much everybody knows, and the Mars Curiosity rover has its own Twitter account. It's kind of taken on a personality of its own.
It's kind of dry humor, right?
Yeah, so I kind of call it the original Martian. Sorry, Mark Watney. But it's fun because people can follow along on Twitter. You know, there's also another parody account called Sarcastic Rover. It tweets about being stuck on Mars and nothing to do but stare at rock. So there's a lot of personality behind it without actual humans on the planet. So that's pretty interesting.
Well, let me just bring the conversation back a little closer to home. It's also a big year for private space companies, especially here on Florida's Space Coast, a bunch of companies setting up shop here. Brendan, tell me about SpaceX. What has that company got going on?
They've got a really busy year. Quite a few things that they're working on. What's really going into this year with a lot of momentum is landing that booster at the Cape. So they took the first stage, which is the big, long booster. They sent up a rocket. Mm-hmm. They were able to recover that booster by landing it vertically on land. So that was huge for them.
They'd tried to do that on a barge before.
They've tried to do it on a barge. They're coming very close to doing it on a barge.
A drone ship, I think.
A drone ship, yeah, that's what I'm supposed to be calling it. But yes, they've come very close. They almost had it off the coast of California, I believe it was. The leg didn't lock.
It came down too hard and the leg did not stick. It was very suspenseful too because I don't know if you were watching it, but the feed cut out like right as it was like 30 seconds before landing. And everyone was just like, did it land?
Mm-hmm.
Did it stick? Well, 20 minutes later, we found out it didn't, but it looked pretty close.
Yeah.
So, but then it went boom. But if they can recover these boosters like they did with the previous one, they fired it back up. They did a ground engine test and it fired back up. No problem.
You've got to remember, they don't usually reuse these. So if you crash one, that's fine. You know, you weren't going
to
use it anyways.
They're used to it.
Yeah, they're used to it. And that's typically the way rocketry is you just get rid of it and build it from scratch. But this is a big deal if they're able to reuse that rocket. Now, there's still a lot of work to be done. They're having some trouble with some debris and they're not able to fire the reusable rockets or be as effective as a brand new one. Mm-hmm. But they are making their way to do that. And it was kind of, shouldn't say this, but it was kind of funny watching this thing because it slowly tipped over. And I mean, this 200-foot booster just kind of slowly tipped over in the barge and then blew up. But they were very close. So using that, they're going to keep trying to do that going forward, learn how to process that booster rocket so that they can reuse it. And they've got some really big milestones they're trying to hit this year. So they've got a contract with NASA to ferry astronauts up to the International Space Station with their Crew Dragon. It's part of the Commercial Crew contract. And so they've got some tests that they have to do. Last year, they did the abort test. So they proved that they could use those abort systems. They'll do a mid-flight abort at some point this year. So they'll actually send the Dragon capsule on a rocket and then shoot it off the rocket and pull it away in case of, you know, emergency. They'll do that.
Mm-hmm.
They had a parachute test pretty recently, and that was really successful. So those are some big milestones, and they want to start sending crew up there next year. I mean, that's a pretty accelerated timeline, but they think they can do it. They're also going to be demonstrating the Falcon Heavy. So this is a really big rocket. It's basically the Falcon 9 that they use with two more Falcon 9s attached to it. And this is for really heavy payload that they want to get up there. But SpaceX is also focusing on more than just launching to low Earth orbit. The Federal Aviation Administration's Commercial Transportation Conference, the SpaceX VP, Gwynne Shotwell, had this to say about the company's long-term goals.
We were founded to move people to other planets, and our focus is on Mars. Elon was pretty clear at a discussion a few days ago that we have a goal of moving people in 9 to 10 years, really aggressive. But if you don't aim high, then you don't get there. So we've got a little bit of work ahead.
That's Gwynne Shotwell from SpaceX talking about their aspirations to get out to deep space beyond low Earth orbit. Now, we saw a successful launch of an Atlas V satellite by United Launch Alliance, but there's also been some issues around the engines used to power those Atlas V rockets. So what's the issue, Brendan?
Those engines are manufactured by a Russian company. And if you go back 2 years and you think about when Russia invaded Crimea and annexed Ukraine, there were some sanctions that the U.S. government put on Russia, and some of those sanctions were not purchasing these rockets anymore, limiting the amount of purchasing, and there was some legislation that was filed, and they were moving in that direction. However, in this last congressional appropriations bill, it was an omnibus bill, they just pushed it forward, and there was some language in there that kind of eased off those restrictions. So now there's been some vocal opponents of that, like Senator John McCain out of Arizona, saying that we shouldn't purchase these rockets or these rocket engines, and we need to move away from it. Here's John McCain. I got some sound of him speaking to the Senate about this issue.
They acted in a way that now provides tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars to Vladimir Putin and his corrupt cronies. How do you justify such action? The American taxpayers should be outraged to learn that some U.S. senators want American taxpayers to continue subsidizing Russian aggression and comrade capitalism. But those very senators thought that if they snuck their blank check to the Putin regime and into an unamendable take-it-or-leave-it omnibus bill, that no one would stop them.
United Launch Alliance is the company that uses these, but it's the Air Force that's paying them to launch these military payloads, which is where Senator McCain is really upset. This is a taxpayer program that's funneling money back to Russia.
Is there an alternative engine then?
There is. ULA is working on its next class of rockets, the Vulcan rocket, to replace the Atlas V. With that would be a new engine being designed, I believe, by Blue Origin is in the running for that one. But also the Air Force has invested into companies like SpaceX and Orbital ATK to start looking at alternative engines to this Russian RD-180 engine. I mean, it's a workhorse, and it's been on the Atlas V for quite some time now. So it's a little bit harder to replace it than just saying, hey, go find a new engine. There's not a Walmart of engines out there. You know, it's rocket science. It's difficult, and you've got to manufacture it pretty efficiently.
Mm-hmm. But I guess with the changing nature of space exploration and a lot of more commercial companies getting involved in the mix, there could be a Walmart of rocket engines.
Absolutely. And one of the proposals that SpaceX put out with this Air Force grant they have is actually 3D printing this engine. So, I mean, you could basically just manufacture it wherever you had a 3D printer.
Emily Speck, let me just ask you finally, what do you find kind of generates the most interest from your readers? Are people really fascinated by what these little probes are doing way out in the deep reaches of the solar system, or are they more fired up about human exploration and getting people back up into space from U.S. soil?
People are really excited to see more rocket launches than ever from the Space Coast. It's not generating as much interest as the space shuttle with humans on board, but they are also excited about the space probes. You know, the New Horizons spacecraft, that was so great, and it was so epic, and it really felt like everyone was involved. I mean, just because they were so public with the image releases and we're not even halfway done with the data downloads. So, you know, there's still more to come. So it's still very exciting. And when those first images came down, it was just a scientific bonanza. It was great because, you know, there was ice volcanoes and, you know, different varied terrain. It was really interesting. But it will be amazing when we can get crewed spacecraft to launch from Cape Canaveral again.
Emily Speck writes for the Orlando Sentinel's Go for Launch blog. Thanks for joining us, Emily.
Thank you.
And Brendan Byrne is 90.7 Space Reporter. Thanks, Brendan.
No problem, Matt. Thank you.
This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Still to come, private companies are working to send astronauts into space, but they're also interested in using space resources like water and minerals. After the break, we'll talk to Bob Richards from Moon Express. His company is developing a spacecraft that can hop around the surface of the moon and prospect for resources to help set up what he describes as a gas station on the moon. Welcome back to Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Bob Richards describes himself as an orphan of Apollo. He says he was inspired by the first astronauts walking on the moon. Now he's working to fulfill the promise of space exploration. Bob Richards is the co-founder of Moon Express. It's a private space company with their sights set on mining the moon for natural resources. The company's also currently competing in Google's Lunar X Prize. Bob, thank you so much for joining me.
I'm very happy to be here.
I wonder if you could just start by explaining what it is your company is doing and maybe a couple of the projects you're working on.
So Moon Express has a long-term vision of unlocking the resources of the moon for the benefit of humanity. So it's not unlike several hundred years ago when we were looking across the ocean at a new continent and sending voyages there to discover what was there. We're now looking across the ocean of space, looking at a new continent, the eighth continent called the moon, which we've learned in recent years is just a treasure trove of natural resources. And everything that we, for instance, mine on Earth, all of the precious metals and gold and platinum, silver and everything else actually came from space. So, you know, as it landed on the Earth, it also landed on the moon. And one of the advantages of reaching out to the moon to gather resources for use on planet Earth and our movement out into space is that the moon doesn't have a biosphere. There's no tall blue people that we know about that we would displace, and it's a stepping stone as a result to the solar system. So we look at the moon as kind of a gateway to the solar system, a gas station in the sky, and it's a game changer for our movement as a species out into space and becoming a multi-world species.
Okay, so Bob Richards, what kind of resources are you looking for specifically? If you talk of it as a gas station to outer space, like what kind of things would you need if you're looking to launch an expedition into deep space?
Well, the most important thing that you need in space, just like for any voyage, is fuel. And the thing that makes space travel so expensive these days is that we have to take all the fuel with us when we launch from Earth and go into space. That's why, you know, about 15/16 of the mass of the space shuttle was fuel, because the fuel was needed to lift the fuel. And Earth is at the bottom of such a deep gravity well that if only we had fuel in space, it would make things much easier. Imagine if you needed to drive from one coast of the United States to the other coast and there were no gas stations along the way, that you would have to take all the fuel with you and what that would look like of planning for the trip. So the good news is that we've recently discovered that there's water on the moon. And water, H2O, is very exciting because its constituents, hydrogen and oxygen, are the components of the most powerful rocket fuel known. So water is like the oil of the solar system, and it's in abundance on the moon. That's why I call it a gas station in the sky. And if we could learn how to go to the moon and live off the land and be able to harvest the water resources on the moon, that makes the economics of the moon and all the other resources there eligible for consumption on Earth and our use in space, and it unlocks the solar system for us. So it's the water on the moon that's the first resource that we're after. So Moon Express is looking for its first gusher.
The spacecraft you're developing, that's going to run on basically components of hydrogen and oxygen?
That's right. So the spacecraft, so we are developing new rocket engines to run on hydrogen peroxide as a fuel. And hydrogen peroxide is H2O2, so kind of oxygen-infused water. And hydrogen peroxide is it's a green fuel. It's very powerful. And we like the idea of using it because we'll be able to reconstitute the fuel from the water on the moon. And it's not like you can land on the moon and, you know, put your hose into the dirt and suck out the hydrogen peroxide. There's a lot between now and then, but the point is the elements of hydrogen and oxygen in the form of water are in abundance on the moon. And the first thing we need to do as a space exploration company is to explore the moon from an entrepreneurial perspective. So Moon Express has a long-term vision of unlocking these resources, but that's a decade away. What we're doing today is we're creating new innovative low-cost spacecraft with a goal of collapsing the cost of access to the moon, much like SpaceX is collapsing the cost of access from Earth to space. Our spacecraft take over once we're in Earth orbit and are able to reach the moon. So we're really in the transportation business to begin with, carving or blazing those trails, just like in the early explorers, to a new world.
Mm-hmm.
And once we've blazed those trails, we'll be able to explore the moon and find out where those resources are and start to learn how to utilize them.
So, Bob, when you talk about the engines you're developing, the spacecraft, this spacecraft is going to be hitching a ride on a rocket. What does it do once it gets there?
So the first time, our first mission, our goal is just to land softly. So only three superpowers in human history have ever landed on the moon. That's because it's very hard to do.
Mm-hmm.
And it was done by, you know, hundreds of thousands of people with the gross national product of a superpower behind them. The remarkable thing is today, a group of 50 people in an entrepreneurial company that can be funded by risk capital is able to do the things that only superpowers could do about 40 years ago. So our first goal is to soft land on the moon. Mm-hmm. and become the first private sector company to do so. In our first mission, we'll be delivering a number of scientific and exploration payloads to the surface of the moon. It'll be profitable for us on our first mission forward, really in the transportation, kind of the FedEx to the moon business to begin with. So on our first mission, we'll be doing a number of things that satisfy a number of customers, scientific and commercial. We'll also be doing what's necessary to win the Google Lunar X Prize. And Google thinks it's important from an inspirational perspective for a private sector company to be able to land on the moon and send back video and high-definition images. So that's one of the things that we'll be doing in addition to satisfying the requirements of our other customers, including NASA.
So what? Tell me a little bit more about the Google Lunar X Prize. What's at stake, and how important is that to what you're involved in, what your company's doing?
Sure. Well, Google in 2007 introduced a $30 million purse for the first private company to be able to reach the surface of the moon with a robot, send back high-definition images and video, and to do it again from a 500 meters away from your land. So there's a component of mobility required. There's no specificity of how you need to do it. And a number of teams that have entered the competition have presumed that you need rovers to crawl off of the lander and rove across the lunar scape. Not our approach. We believe that if we've flown 250,000 miles to the moon, what's so hard about going another 500 meters? So our spacecraft will actually take off again from the moon and fly 500 meters or more and land again. And this is part of the agility of our spacecraft, being able to make one large trip to the moon, but to explore its surface by hopping around or flying around to various locations.
So it's kind of like a lunar pogo stick in some ways.
Yes, I think you could. Yes, I haven't heard that description before, but I think that's very accurate, yes.
What got you interested in space exploration? What's your background?
Well, I don't remember a time when I wasn't fascinated with space exploration. As a matter of fact, as I speak to you, I'm looking across the water at the Vehicle Assembly Building at Kennedy Space Center. We're located here down in Florida at Cape Canaveral. My earliest memories are walking around the rocket garden at Kennedy Space Center as a little boy with my family on vacation. Personally, I'm an orphan of Apollo. You know, as a little boy, and my whole generation was inspired by Apollo. Watching people walk in another world, and that set an expectation for what I would be experiencing when I grew up. But my generation, we graduated from high school and college, and it wasn't happening. So this really is, when you look at the all the billionaires who have made their fortunes through the Internet, which is really a product of their generation, almost to a person, they're reinvesting their money into space exploration. And that's because we're all orphans of Apollo. So this is really creating the future that inspired us when we were young. Mm-hmm. And it's the advance of technology and the concentration of capital into the hands of the few that are making it not just affordable but doable. And so we're in an era, a new epoch of where we will truly become a multiplanetary species. And amazing organizations like NASA will continue to push the boundaries of human experience. But they're getting out of the transportation business. That's something that the private sector can do better. So all of these companies, from SpaceX to Blue Origin to Virgin Galactic and Moon Express, were all in the transportation business, as were the earliest companies that delivered the mail for the government. And what we'll see now is a new era where this innovation, where the economic reasons for exploring other worlds will become the dominant factor over the exploration reasons. So to go to space to stay, it has to pay. And what we're all doing is expanding the economic sphere of Earth outward. So it's a sustainable process that delivers true value, not just stunts that are one-time things.
Mm-hmm. Bob Richards, thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Bob Richards joined us by phone from the Space Coast. He's the co-founder of the space exploration company Moon Express. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. The executive producer is Catherine Welch. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.